Where can you buy really cheap coffee still? Like McDonald's?
I guess that's McDonald's cheap is probably cheap. Yeah. I don't know. Cup of coffee for a buck. Those of you who are listening and haven't yet tuned out, where can you get a cup of coffee for a buck? A decent cup of coffee.
Oh, whoa. You're putting qualifiers on it. That complicates things.
All right. It is. Let's start this thing. It's Tuesday, May 16th. Yep. I'm ahead of the game. And it's on taking pictures.
Yep.
Right. Yep. And you're Bill Wadman.
Sometimes.
Brooklyn. Jeffrey Sidoris. Silver Spring, Maryland.
Current pollen count 10.3
million.
Exactly. Actually, I wonder what that 10.3 refers to. Right. Just
the number of times you're going to sneeze before the show is over.
It's more just like phlegm in my throat for me. It's just sort of like I feel scratchy, you know.
Hey, I'm listening to the radio.
Oh God, why would I'm
listening to the radio this morning? Well, Sirius XM. I love Sirius XM. Love it.
You pay for Sirius XM? What, in the car?
Yeah. Okay. Love Sirius XM. So one of the stations that I listen to is First Wave. Because it's 80s music.
Right. Reminds you of your 40s.
Right. Channel 33, for those of you who have XM. And so they're doing kind of the station IDs, you know, where they have, oh, this is so-and-so, this is so-and-so. And one came on, and it said, this is Michael Hutchins from NXS. And then they, you know, they played New Sensation.
Right. Sure.
And I thought, am I reading this wrong? Or this feels kind of weird that they've got Michael Hutchins, who died, you know, a decade or more before XM radio was even a thing. And the implication is that he is somehow endorsing the playing of their music on it. It just felt really weird. Am I reading that wrong?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. So they pulled it from some.
Yeah. It could have been like, you know, this, my name is Michael Hutchins station, and you're listening to, you know, KLOS or MTV.
Remember when that
MTV
used to be a thing? Is that still a thing?
I don't know. Like, I don't listen Beyonce to a lot of terrestrial radio. I don't know. Maybe.
Is it creepy? Yeah, it's a little creepy.
It felt kind of weird.
Yeah, because that was, right. So he died.
When did he die?
97.
97? Okay.
Right.
So yeah, a decade probably or more before Sirius was even a thing. And it was like, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, remember that Fred Astaire commercial where they CG'd Fred Astaire with like a Swiffer or something? What was that?
Yeah. It's the same as the, wasn't there the Kung Fu guy, Bruce Lee, right?
Didn't they do
same kind of thing? Lee with playing nunchucks, playing ping pong with nunchucks.
Right.
Yeah. It's just
It just feels kind of weird.
I completely agree. Yeah. Did you make you turn the channel?
Oh no, because I like NXS.
No, you enjoyed New Sensation.
It's a great song. come on, that little riff at the beginning. Come
famously
on.
Wait, that's the big album, right? What's the big record?
Kick,
right.
Yeah.
So Bob Clearmountain mixed Kick, and they recorded that album normally, like as a full band with all kinds of stuff all playing at the same time. And when Bob Clearmountain came in, he's the guy who did the bang, like broke it all up into like very isolated elements. That was not the original arrangement. That was sort of created in the mix, and people loved it. So in some ways, the reason why that album is such a big deal is because this mix engineer, the average person has never heard of, who basically, you know, he's sort of like the film editor, you know, who did the crazy stuff with the footage. But yeah, it's good stuff.
Hey, you just inspired me for something. I was thinking about this the other day, and I meant to call you. Right. I know. Jesus. 260.
Jeez.
What is this episode? 265? 264. Okay. So, correct me if I'm wrong. A producer, musically.
Yeah.
A producer comes in and helps to mold and shape the sound of the final record. And it may be pushing and pulling and dragging the band kicking and screaming towards something that they didn't really see or want to do, but it ends up being this amazing end product. Is that fair?
Yes. Producer in record terms is almost more like a director in film terms, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So my question is, would it benefit photographers, let's say, since
to
this
have
is
a producer.
To have a producer to go, look, I know you have this body of work that you want to do, but I'm seeing something a little different and I want you to try this. I want you to go in this direction.
Yeah.
And you may not want to, but it may yield something that you didn't see or weren't able to get to on your own, but inspires either a single image, sure, a body of work, or a new direction for multiple bodies of work.
Yep.
And I've just kind of wondered why we don't, you know, we think of photography as this sort of lone wolf, solitary pursuit, but could we not benefit from outside direction, outside influence, outside inspiration?
Sure. And I think some people do. I mean, you could ask the same question of a painter or, you know, I think that, I mean, there are producers in the photo world, but generally they're people who make things happen, right? They are facilitators.
Right.
You know,
I look at a ton of photography and I go, man, if they would have just done this, it could have been so much stronger.
Sure. Yeah. But that, I mean, the problem is a lot of people say that 16 people could say the same thing about the image in different directions, you know?
Right, right.
Oh, they should have taken more color out. They should put more color in, you know?
Well, but that's where their value comes in. That's where sort of Rick Rubin and Clear Mountain and...
Sure,
and,
yep. And, but, you know. And are there people out there who are so good that they're... This is an interesting thing because in some ways you could almost see Crutzen is more of a producer than a traditional photographer, right? Because he has his team of people who do lighting, who shoot the stuff, who edit the stuff. He's like a guy behind the scenes sort of directing it like a movie, right? I think that the you could certainly have that happen in photography. I just you'd have to have people that people really trusted. And it's interesting because there are some producers who themselves are or were musicians themselves, right? You know, Rick Ocasek will go in and produce people, right?
Or
that kind of thing. And then there's people like Rick Rubin who have only ever been Rick Rubin going in and producing other people, right? So like that's their magic. The other thing is that in many ways a record, the idea for producers in a recording sense is generally that you are trying to get something out of the artist that's already there, as opposed to say, I want you to make a record that sounds like a Cars record. You know,
right? Understood. But couldn't we benefit from that in visual arts too?
Sure, absolutely. But I.
It comes down to sort of relinquishing control at some point.
Yeah. And then at that point, is it collaboration or is it still the artist's name on it? You know. It's funny how many people listen to say an In Excess record, and don't think about the producer or the engineer as a very important element of it. In the same way that people look at Annie or Seliger's pictures and don't take the retouchers into account when they have the best in the business there and their images out of camera do not look like the final images that you see. So,
right. Or George Martin and the Beatles.
Right. And now he's an example of somebody who people who know anything about the Beatles know that George Martin was their producer. And yeah, the Beatles would not have been the Beatles without George Martin. But it's interesting because George Martin is an example where, yeah, he'd come to them and say, or they'd go to him and say, oh, we think it needs something else. And he'd go, no, you need a string quartet. And they'd go, really? And he'd go, yeah, I can make an arrangement for Eleanor Rigby or something, right?
Right.
And then he goes and gets a string quartet and writes a little arrangement and puts it in there. And that changes the song. And the song is something way more than it ever was before or whatever, right? But George Martin can't make that music without the Beatles. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
George Martin himself wasn't making music. He was only able to facilitate the Beatles making their music, right? So I think there's a fine line in any artwork between somebody trusting somebody enough to give them advice or say, you know, Jeffrey, maybe you should try something a little less monochromatic or whatever it is that your current line is, right? Mm-hmm. which is that advice or is that producing?
Well, you know? I mean, I think it goes a little further than that. I mean, you bring up Gregory and, you know, his relationship with Rick Sands, his lighting director.
It's totally collaborative.
Director of photography, rather. It's collaborative from day one. I mean, right. it's a partnership, and the work that they do together, I think is in large part a byproduct of, you know, hours of conversation and not just Gregory having his view and everybody else is there to implement it, but it seems in you know, the limited experience I've had talking to him about it, that it is a very collaborative environment. He knows what he wants.
But it's only his name on it at the end.
Which is
always kind of interesting, right?
I mean, in the same way that it's, you know, Ridley Scott directed Blade Runner. Well, yep. It took hundreds and hundreds of people to pull that off, or yep. Alien Covenant or whatever. Sure. You know, but at the end of the day, if it wins Best Picture, you know, the producer gets it in Best Picture. If it wins Best Director, he gets it, not everybody else who worked
on it.
The best,
you know, the film producers winning the award for the Best Picture is a weird thing, because film producers are all about facilitation and money, right? Like, they're just like, how do we get these people in the same room at the same time so they can make this thing happen mm-hmm. and have the bucks to back it up, right? That's the sort of job of a producer in movies. Is that correct? From what I understand?
That's the way I understand it. And assembling, you know, sort of the core team that then assembles the rest of the team.
Yeah. But it's not a creative position in the same way that it is in other world realms.
I don't think to the same degree, no.
Yeah. It is interesting. I guess you could. I mean, that also goes into writing clubs and writing circles, right? Like, should people get together and show each other their work and, you know, bounce off each other if they're feeling like they're hitting a wall? I mean,
I think
that kind of stuff happens too. Sure.
Is the short answer.
Sure.
You know, I mean, we went up to Lowell, Massachusetts and went to this thing called Western Avenue Art Studios.
Oh yeah. We talked about that last week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that the idea of an artistic community, I mean, we see the same thing happening in the group, you know,
right.
on the same
sure.
kind of level, where you've got artists supporting other artists and offering, you know, critique where asked, sometimes when not asked. But that community of support, that creative community, I think is incredibly valuable.
Yep.
Much more so than, you know, light this way or post-process this way. I think the deeper that connection can go with people who may be similar to what you do or in many cases different than what you do,
sure,
can affect much more profoundly the quality of the work that comes out of it.
I also think that there's room for a small cadre of people that you can show your work to that you trust.
Absolutely.
As opposed to taking advice from everybody, right? I think
absolutely.
I think advice is one of those things that needs to be calibrated.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I was, David Dushman has a new book coming out, and we had a conversation about the book, and we talked about that very thing where he has a small group of people that he will invite critique from. But as far as, you know, critique from the world at large, he's really not interested.
No, and it's a big giant mess if you do.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair thing. You know, you trust the people that you trust, and I think that's the healthiest way to do it. I don't know. People feel the need to comment on everything.
Sure.
And I think that there's room to have a more meaningful dialogue than just a heart or a like, but at the same time, that's a fine line between commentary and critique.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's always nice having people say, oh, that's lovely or what have you. But then there's other people who will come out and say, I don't like the way his left finger is or whatever. And it's
right,
just like,
right.
it's, oh my God, talk about nitpicking for the sake of nitpicking. You know, a lot of times you don't have that kind of level of control. Photography is not painting most of the time, right? You don't, or at least the kind of photography most of us do is not controlled down to the level of a lot of other arts. you know, what's in front of our camera is what in front of our camera. If you're doing a still life, sure, you can take the picture, obsess about the way that flower is turned and go and turn it 1/4 of 1 degree or something like that. But if you're out in the world or shooting people or what haven't, you're never going to get 100% of everything exactly perfect for what you're trying mm-hmm. to do. It's just, mm-hmm. it's unrealistic. So I always find those kinds of comments interesting. It's like, do you think I was trying to have it a little awkward? Maybe I was, you know what I mean? But,
right.
But more likely than not, it's, this maybe is, it's not happenstance in there.
You weren't trying to make it awkward, but maybe you just didn't see that it was.
Yeah, sure.
You know, did you notice that this, you know?
I mean, there are times when I'll shoot, if I'm shooting somebody for, this has happened a couple of times for like work stuff, where I'll shoot some guy and only notice when I get home that the bottom of his tie was peeking out or slipped or, you know what I mean? Something right. like that. Because I'm worrying about his face and the fact that he's feeling awkward in front of the camera. I'm not thinking about the bottom of his tie. Now, if you have a bigger budget and you can have people on set and there's a wardrobe person who goes, oh, hold on a second, he goes and fix the tie. Like that happens all the time too, right? And that's why you have bigger teams of people. But at the same time, I'd rather have a nice picture of the guy feeling natural with a tie I've got to clean up later or do something with, rather than awkward pictures of a guy who's super stiff because we're overanalyzing the shape of every piece of clothing he's wearing, you know?
Sure. But then that also makes the case for, you know, a stylist on set so sure. that you don't have to worry about
absolutely.
And if other
you
people
have the
can.
Budget, right? And that's the thing is that a lot of times you don't have the budget. So it's, you know, you bring people in when you can and you don't obsess when you can't, you know?
Right. Right.
And not to mention the fact that for the great majority of pictures that any of us will ever take, and that includes me and that includes people way more successful than me, the average person is going to look at it for half a second and look away to the next page. They're not analyzing it the way you are, you know, in the same way that I, you know, we went to the show the other night and they did the whole, you know, oh, there's a banana over on a table on this side of the stage. And, oh, did you notice the gorilla that just came out and took the banana off it? And no one noticed. 300 people in the audience staring at the stage. No one noticed a gorilla come out and grab the banana because right. that's just the way our attention works, right? Now, if you were sitting there and you were obsessing about it on video, you'd go, oh, it's very obvious that the gorilla came out and ate the banana. So I don't know. It's attention is an interesting. Well, that's interesting in general, but it's certainly interesting from the point of view of photography. It's like, how do you both define attention in your images and direct your viewer towards what you want them to view and away from other things, or just so they don't notice details that are somewhat irrelevant that some people may pick up on and nitpick.
Right,
know?
Right, right, right.
So it's all interesting. Yeah. So maybe we need producers.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it just, I got to thinking about it and went, you know, what would happen if?
Sure. Yeah.
You know,
I think that, it's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are people who do and are, aren't there?
I would assume so. Maybe art directors.
Yeah. I mean, that's an element of it. Sure. But you know, for every art director I thought added something, there was another one who just mm-hmm. had to add their 2 cents because but, they were getting
well
paid.
And that also seems to be on the commercial side. I'm talking sure. more, you know, a personal body of work where sure. where you've got a collaborator that maybe does see things differently than you do.
Right. What do you think about artist teams, right? Where it's husband and wife or two guys or two girls or whatever.
Oh, I think it's terrific. I think yeah. it's terrific. There are a couple that I've been following for a while. There's a team up in New York, Joseph Paradiso and Yuki Tsang. They're fashion photographers and they are phenomenal and they right. work beautifully together.
And whatever they shoot goes down as both of them.
I think they're it's branded Paradiso.
Okay.
Because that's just such a great name. I mean, right? Joseph Paradiso, come on. That's a fantastic name.
Right.
So I think that's the umbrella brand, but they're very great about crediting one another and showing BTS and tagging one another and you know, they seem to work really, really well together.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's a little bit like a design thing, like what's the big pentagram?
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, okay, well, we've got 5 or 6 big shot people in here and a bunch of lower end people, but everything just goes out as
It's Pentagram done by Pentagram, yeah. Or, you know, the another husband and wife, famously, Charles and Ray Eames.
Sure, yep.
You know, they
although if
they,
you watch those movies, it's like one of them had much more of a draw than the other, and then they, in some ways, the whole, oh, we're doing this together was a PR thing, right?
I think they contributed, from what I have read, they contributed quite a bit to one another.
Okay,
that,
fair enough.
That whether it was a muse-like relationship or whether it was an active collaboration, I think that the work would have been very different had they not been together.
Yeah. I don't know. It's very complicated. Hey, we got some emails. You want to pop into these?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I read the John Dubois. I just kind of glanced over it when it came in, and I thought it initially said white or not.
Right.
I was wait.
Where's this going?
Yeah. I need to dive into this a little better. So John writes, right or not, WRITE. There were two interesting, provocative articles that serendipitously I saw last week. That seems a common seesaw topic in art and photography, and I thought at some point it would be a good topic for OTP. A conversation based on a straightforward question. Does a photograph or a body of work need writing? What role does writing the written work and artist statement serve? Required, essential, or not? And he goes on to cite, there's a juror's comment at Review Santa Fe, commenting on, quote, the artist's statement, and it reads as follows. For years, I would walk out of the room when someone started talking about their photographs. I just wanted to look, to experience photos as a purely visual language. Eventually, I circled back around with words, especially once I realized that I needed them for portfolio statements and grant proposals. That used correctly, words support the photos, provide a framework and another layer of meaning for times when photos just can't do everything on their own, end quote.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Well, okay. I think that there is absolutely no absolute for this, right? There's required, essential, not... I don't think it's essential. I don't think it's required. I think occasionally in certain situations it's useful. There are sets of images that I've seen that I was like, that's not really that all that. And then you read a little bit about it, and if it's well written and it's not added just to add pretense, if it's actually explaining something that is otherwise not understood, well, then that's really interesting to me. Remember, there was a couple of years ago? I remember seeing something at MoMA where it was this set of different exposures, dark to light and dark to light, and it turned out one set was created by waiting in time, and then the other set was created by doing one was done by shutter speed and one was done just by waiting for the sun to go down slowly. So they were identical exposures along this thing, but they were created two different ways. Now, if you just looked at it, it was like a dock and some water overlooking the Hudson River.
It was not
an inspiring photograph. And then it was, oh, different exposures of the same photograph. Oh, they're stacking them. Who gives a crap? And then you read it and you go, oh, that's kind of interesting. The fact that they're showing, you know, it's sort of this analysis of exposure and what it means and time passing. And that's kind of interesting.
I think by and large, context is a good thing.
Yes. But in the same way that I find it very difficult myself to write about my work in any way that doesn't sound ridiculous. I've never had that gene, whatever the gene is you have to be able to talk about your work in a, and when I was in high school, there was a guy named Mr. Elges who was one of our teachers. He was a history teacher. He was my civics teacher in the ninth grade. And he looked exactly like the Grinch. And he was this old guy. And every year at Christmas,
Billy, did you get his heart to swell three sizes?
Well, that's the thing. So, and he kind of talked like the Grinch too. He had like this really long look.
Mr. Wadman.
No, totally. And in fact, at Christmas, he used to read The Grinch in the library for everyone. Like once a year, it was like this thing.
Nice.
And he was a much older gentleman. And he every year at the senior assembly or whatever it is, he used to hand out what he called the golden shovel for each class. And the golden shovel was for the student who had the best bullshit, right? And I won the Golden Shovel.
Do you have a closet full
of
Golden Shovels?
I was the Golden Shovel winner my freshman year. And I still have it in the closet, actually, funny enough. But for me, almost always when I'm writing about my work, it feels to me like BS. And I think part of that is because I don't think most of my images require all that much writing or are improved by me talking about them very much.
Well, right? And that's a very important distinction, Bill. Right. There's a chasm between fluff and context.
Absolutely. But if there's a sense in the zeitgeist that, oh, well, you know what? These images can speak for themselves, but people will respond to this more in this world if I come up with some way to describe it that supposedly adds meaning to it. Mm-hmm. I think that it's very tempting to try to, you know, spend the art school pretense. I think that happens a lot. I think there's a lot of times I read labels that are entirely superfluous. And there are times when it's useful, but I think the times that it's useful are by far the minority in my experience. Mm-hmm. Do you think that any of our favorite photographers' work would really be improved by, you know, you know, we went to see the Irving Penn show at the Met yesterday, which, by the way, if you're in the New York area, you should go see it because it's pretty cool. They have not only great prints and the whole thing, but they also have one of his backdrops laid out and his Rolly sitting there. It's pretty cool. But I don't think any of those Irving Penn pictures are better because there's two paragraphs of stuff next to them. You know,
I disagree.
Okay.
I disagree.
Okay. Let me say they're no better for me. Like, I don't appreciate those images more after reading the labels. Go ahead.
But Irving Penn is one of your icons. He's one of your all-time greats. If someone's walking in off the street and looking at these photos and going, why should I care about this? Why is Irving Penn iconic?
Sure. Okay.
Then, why is this guy important?
Right. And you have a paragraph or two at the front just saying Irving Penn was an American portrait photographer, blah, 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 blah. Like, you know, the first couple of paragraphs of a Wikipedia entry. But I don't think that looking at those pictures and having a thing next to it that says, this is a picture of Gene Harlow and blah, 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 blah. And like his use of light and shade and blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, yeah, we can tell all that by looking at the image. It's like when they talk to football players at the end of the game, it's like, so what happened out there? Well, we scored more, got the ball into the end zone more than it's like, yeah, I know that by the score. I don't need to have you talk about it, you know? And I think so my version of this, John, and Jeffrey and I disagree slightly on this. I lean more towards I'd rather not have it. If the question is yes or no, I'd say no, where I think you would rather tend on the side of yes.
Yeah, I mean, again, yeah. I really enjoy the context.
And you're more of a words guy than I am.
Okay, yeah, maybe.
I mean, you write well and I don't. So that,
yeah,
you know.
Thank
that,
you, maybe. Yeah, I do enjoy it. I think we have the same or a very similar sort of BS meter.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do enjoy, you know, I read the plaques. I enjoy that. I read, you know, the lead in to exhibitions, because you never know what you're going to find. You never know who, you know, you'll see in there that influenced, you know, X, Y, or Z.
Sure.
In the same way that I would read liner notes constantly on LPs.
Yep.
Or the tour programs at concerts when they still used to do tour programs. You know, you never know what you're going to find in there. And, you know, I like the context. I like fleshing out that world.
Yeah. You never know what you're going to find in there. You know, it's interesting that I feel like the writing about photographs or writing about art is a very 20th century thing, right? There weren't, you know, they didn't ask Van Gogh to write about his stuff or Michelangelo. There's no essay about the Sistine ceiling that Michelangelo wrote, as far as I know.
Oh, but maybe somebody else did.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, and you're right. There is a requisite level of skill
in writing.
In the writing that's required to pull it off.
Yeah, I think there's a requisite skill in the writing, and I think there's also a requisite complication in whether like sort of prima facie. If you can look at the work and get where it's going without somebody explaining it, because it's kind of all there, it's just, you know, ready to wear kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think then it's like, okay, well, take it or leave it. If it's something like that crazy exposure thing I was talking about, which is almost in some ways an exercise where that is the result of a thought experiment and you need to explain to me the thought experiment before I'll understand the results. Well, then sure. Yeah. Put a label on.
Yeah. And by and large, I agree with you. And there are standouts. And the one that comes to mind is Bruce Springsteen's autobiography. You can listen to Nebraska. You can listen to The River. You can listen to Born to Run. You can listen to, you know, Darkness on the Edge of Town. And they all stand alone as individual bodies of work and collectively as Bruce's entire body of work. But when you hear or read, depending on how you, if you have the choice, I highly recommend you get the audiobook because it's him reading his own words, which is fantastic. That history lesson, that context that he provides of where that music came out of allows me as a listener to appreciate it even more or to recognize some of the nuance that went into it.
Couldn't you argue, though, in that case that Bruce's book itself is just another piece of art? That is, you could read that book, never listen to the music, and still get something out of Bruce Springsteen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
So in some ways, that's not commentary on the music. That is a whole other bag of worms.
Well, I think it stands on it stands in both houses, right? Okay. It's a commentary on the music, but it is also just a terrific read about an artist trying to find his way and find himself and find a style and find a sound and find a group of friends or a group of collaborators that can go on that journey with him and spend the next, you know, after Born to Run anyway, spend the next 30 years inspired by that one. He's become sort of self-referential.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, where he's inspired by this one record that was a fictional tale of this one Friday night in Jersey.
Right.
And sort of everything has sprung from that, you know. Now he'll say that, agreed. Wrecking Ball is up there though, man. Wrecking Ball is a terrific record. He will tell you, and has said this, that overall, like in his mind, the theme behind everything is the disconnect between the American dream and the American reality.
Sure. Right.
But the way that is told over those albums is reinforced by reading how he got there.
Right.
By reading that context of family life, school life, early rock and roll influences, et cetera, et cetera. That strengthens, I think, the end product of the art.
Yes, arguably. Yeah. But the theme of Bruce Springsteen's music, to your point, I don't think is A, unique to Bruce Springsteen, or B, that misunderstood without him explaining it. You know, whenever I meet people from New Jersey, I'm always like, why is it that all the music from New Jersey, whether it's Bon Jovi or Springsteen, it's always people wanting to leave New Jersey. Like, let's get in the car and get the hell out of here, you know. But and like that, and that's just the way his stuff is, right? I don't know. The second link that John gives is this the Petapixel post from last year that I think we discussed at the time. Basically, the guy's saying, look, everyone's got these amazing cameras, everyone's taking pictures. Please give me less words and more and better pictures. I find the story, the text, mostly boring and condescending. I will go with the condescending thing. I think labels and explanatory text can often, the tone can be often very condescending. Like, you know, oh, you plebeian masses, you wouldn't understand this except that I'm explaining it to you. Telling me how to look at the photographs rather than letting the photographs do the talking. So I don't know. If I had to pick one of these two things that I agree with more, I agree more with the Petapixel post than I do the juror statement from above. But we'll put the links in the show notes.
Yes, yes. But there are also a whole lot of really bad photos out there.
And I think that's the guy's point, right? You know, like, just shut up about your pictures.
Don't make
just
more
take
photos.
Better pictures.
Make better photos. Make more intentional pictures. Yep. Make more compelling pictures.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
But if you're going to do it, Bill,
yeah,
should you use a full frame sensor or a crop sensor.
You know, it's funny. We recorded an episode of Ask Bill and Dan the other night where somebody wrote in and asking a similar question.
What? Wait. Have you released? You haven't released one of those in ages. Yeah, what's going on?
We have four in the can that I just have to get around to editing. I've just been busy. So yeah, those are coming. So
Tyler Grinstead.
Tyler writes in and says,
"Hey Tyler," and it is a valid issue. Tyler ends his email. Did you see that?
For any reason this comes to the podcast, feel free to read the email and my name. Though I think it would be unlikely the conversation would come up.
Well, it's like, Tyler, you've never listened to this show. Things come up all the time over and over and over and over again.
So
On Taking Pictures is one big, long Groundhog Day about photography.
Yeah, we never actually talk about photography. Christmas 2014, his work gave either an iPad or a D5200, which is a Nikon, like, medium-low-end digital SLR.
Correct.
He chose the 5200. So he got into photography. He bought a couple of lenses, which, as far as I can tell, may or may not be crop lenses. I don't know. That's a good question. Okay, 3 years later, he wants to upgrade.
51.8 and a Sigma 70-300.
Yeah, I think the 51.8 is probably full frame, and the Sigma, though, I don't know. I'll have to check. He wants to shoot more landscapes. He also wants to shoot motorsports and nature. He's been looking at the D500 and the D810. The D500 is the high-end 20 megapixel, 10 frame a second cropped camera. The D810 is the 36 megapixel full frame sensor, et cetera, et cetera. The budget for the body is about $3,000, so he could do either. Although I think right now the D500 is pretty cheap. It's like $1,700. $1,799 on Nikon's site the other day. It was on sale $200 less than it normally would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, normally $2,000. And it was, you can get a D810 on eBay for $13, $15.
That's it?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I mean, list, I think they're still like $28, I think, is the new price. Anyway, so
let me see.
Yeah,
let me see.
You're well within your budget there.
About $2,000.
Yeah, okay. I don't do this as a profession, but at some point maybe make some weekend projects to supplement my income, maybe sell a few prints on the side, things like that. I daydream of breaking the chains of my 9-to-5 and freelance photography, but that won't be anytime soon. Should I stick with a crop sensor, upgrade to full frame? If so, why? Should I just buy more lenses for my current body? What advantages do full frame sensors have to a crop sensor for a non-professional? Suggestions on the D500 or D810? Should I consider another camera? If you like Nikon, stick with Nikon.
I mean, D810 is probably not the equivalent to that. If you're choosing between crop and full frame at that level, it would be the D500 and probably D610? The D750. No, D750.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But both the D810 is another step up.
Right. And the both are within his price range. So
yeah. Yeah. I mean,
go ahead.
I don't know, man. It's the D500 is fast. It's got
amazing autofocus. You've also got a huge soft spot for the D300 from your past.
I do.
This is the D500.
Yeah, Tyler. If the D500 is the best feeling camera I've ever held in terms of my hands, the way I hold a camera, it feels like it was made for my hands.
And that is a big element of stuff that everyone should think about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, people are, oh, it's 20 megapixel. Okay. Well, that's not fine. Huge. You've already, so on paper, you're going down because your D5200 is probably the 24.1 or 24.3, whatever,
is
megapixel
it really?
Sensor. Yeah. Yeah. I may be wrong, but
my
I think
guess is that it's a much better sensor.
Yeah, I mean it's you know, night and day above in terms of dynamic range, and the autofocus system is incredible.
Yep.
The downside to the D500 is while it does have two card slots, only one of them is an SD.
One of
the other one
is XQD.
Yeah, XQD, which, you know, whatever. You're doing landscape and sports.
See, the problem is in sports, I would say do the 500 because it's got the better autofocus system.
Yeah. And you've got the crop is going to give you a little extra reach.
Yep. That's exactly right. But that also means that if you want to do landscapes and you want to do wide, now you got to figure out, you have to get like super wide lenses to make them wide enough on a crop sensor. So there's lots of, you know, could go either way kind of situations here.
Now you could also look at, and this is one of the cameras that I've looked at for a while is the EM1 Mark II. For landscapes, it's got the high-res mode that shoots basically a 9-frame or 8-frame composite image that gives you a 68-megapixel RAW file.
Right. So what you got to do, you just got to lock it down on a good tripod.
Lock it down on a good tripod. But then you're also shooting, you know, what is it, 60 frames, 60 RAW frames
yeah.
with autofocus per second?
There used to be, Tyler, a much larger image quality difference between the cropped cameras and the full frame. I personally would still choose a full frame camera, but mm-hmm. I want more control over depth of field and that kind of stuff, which, oh, there's another difference. So the cropped camera will have more stuff will be in focus at a particular aperture just because the sensor's smaller. Sort of a function of physics.
You've got 1.2 lenses and 1.4 lenses.
Absolutely. I'm just saying there is a difference that would, you know, that you might notice. If you go from mm-hmm. a crop camera to a full frame camera, the depth of field stuff is noticeable.
Yeah. In the D500 range, you've also got the Fuji X-T2, which is a superb camera.
So in answer, to simplify the whole thing, yeah, you could go either way. And both of them are perfectly fine. Both of them are great. I mean, if it were me getting that, I'd probably buy the 810 because I'd want the really great dynamic range and the really great, I want the resolution and the dynamic range. But right. the D810 probably doesn't handle quite as smooth, like as sort of sports car-y as the D500 might. So, you know, you can go either way. If you buy the D500 and you get it for $1,800, like it's on sale right now, then you have another $1,000 to buy some more glass for it.
Right.
And if you can, just tend to buy full frame glass anyway, so that if you ever do upgrade to a full frame sensor, you can still use all your lenses.
Yeah, get the D500 and get like one of the Sigma Art lenses.
Yeah. I will say that the 24-70 Nikon 2.8, oof, the newer one,
yep.
God, it's nice. It's so sharp. It's incredibly sharp. So...
And how much is that? Are we in the 2500 range?
Yeah, probably.
Where are we at?
It's probably something like that. But, you know, it's actually sharper, I think, through that range than the primes are that Nikon puts out. Or at least that's true of the Canon side of things. When I used it on the DA10, there was no deficiency. I would use that. I'm a prime guy, and I would use that instead of primes if I had a Nikon.
You're a prime guy?
Yes, I'm primed. I'm primed for...
I'm a prime guy.
I'm primed for our next topic.
Right.
Do you want
Which is what?
You want to talk about our sponsor since we're already like 45 minutes in?
Sure.
You okay?
Yeah. No, let's do that.
Are you feeling a little shaky? You're worried about your website or something?
No, my website's good. My website's good. I love... Wait, what is it?
Uh-huh. This episode
about insert web format here. Web framework.
This episode is sponsored by Squarespace. Make your next move. Build it beautiful. I still like the build it beautiful.
I like build it beautiful.
Make your next move is really good too. Build it beautiful is
make
good.
Your next website. I mean, that's okay, duh.
Yeah.
I mean, make your next website.
Make your next move with Squarespace. Yeah. Yeah. It's not their strongest tagline, but I get what they're going for, right?
The framework makes up for it.
It's aspirational. With Squarespace, you can make your website on Squarespace, and you can use their beautiful award-winning templates and online store to make your website more beautiful than anything you could ever imagine. See that? I threw that in there.
Wait, how do you make it more beautiful than you? Because don't you have to imagine it to be able to build it?
I don't know, man. Sometimes serendipity comes in and then, you know, you turn around and there's a new Squarespace template and you go, wow, that's even more beautiful
than I could ever imagine. There is a new one. Greenwich is a new one.
What does Greenwich look like?
You know, it's all clean and Greenwichy.
Squarespace Greenwich. Let me look at this here.
Is it really green? It's not Greenwich, is it?
No,
it's Greenwich.
But Greenwich is the, Oh, I see. Although, very clean. Mm-hmm.
They should change the font color this of the feels, menu because it gets lost on the white.
Oh, that's true, yeah. This feels like a Dwell magazine.
Yeah. or Pottery Barn catalog.
Yeah, something. That's kind of what they're, I think that's what they're going for. You can also, you can create, go create your beautiful website in Squarespace, all in one platform. There's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. You don't have to worry about security things changing, and you didn't go and patch it, and so you get nailed by the latest, you know, crazy web.
What's the don't cry thing?
Is that
make
the,
me cry?
Is that the crazy thing that's going on
the,
right
the
now?
The thing that took down all the hospitals?
Right. That's, that would not happen on Squarespace because Squarespace takes care of all the security and patching and upgrades. And, you know, all the time you go into Squarespace and they're like, oh, by the way, just to let you know, we've added this feature or this, you know, template or this whatever. And you go, oh, that's pretty cool. Like a little while ago, they added the ability to do HTTPS on your site without having to do anything but checking a box.
I've got it enabled myself.
Squarespace provides award-winning 24/7 customer support. So you can, you know, you can chat with people or email with people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They'll get back to you. They'll answer your questions. They know their stuff. They win awards for this stuff. That's how good they are. And don't forget that Squarespace has added domains. So you can get a unique domain experience that's fully transparent and simple to set up, flexible for any kind of website. So you can go buy your new domain idea. So what
Tyler needs a new camera.com.
Perfect. Absolutely right. Perfect. Squarespace is used by a wide range of creatives, people and businesses, musicians, designers, artists, restaurants, and more. When you want to start your free trial at squarespace.com, go over there and use the offer code OTT. There you go. And you'll get 10% off your first purchase, and you'll show your support for our show, On Taking Pictures. Thank you so much to Squarespace for supporting 5x5 and On Taking Pictures. Squarespace, go make your next move. All right, where do you want to go? Let's talk shortcuts.
So I'm watching this thing, right?
It got very loud, suddenly.
Did it really?
Sorry, I hit play, and it just is blasting. Apparently,
you hit play.
Well, I opened up the link just so I could get to the thing that we're discussing, and
oh, I thought you said I was loud.
It autoplayed. No, the video suddenly got loud.
So I was watching some videos about Mark Knopfler.
Okay.
Who I think is an amazing guitarist. Fantastic technique, and there are a couple of videos out there that are. And thank you. Somebody sent me one. An evening with Mark Knopfler, which I watched. Little acoustic, electric, small. You know, intimate set, really terrific. Kind of like Storytellers. Remember how VH1 used to have Storytellers?
I was kind of like that. Yep.
Yeah. He was talking about his first guitar in one of these videos. How he had to have a red Fender Strat.
Okay.
But his dad couldn't afford it growing up, so he got him this German knockoff. But it was a red. It had to be red. So he got a red Strat. And he said he thinks he even, you know, slept with it the first few nights, and he just loved this guitar, but his dad couldn't afford an amp. So he, you know, ended up borrowing acoustic and got into folk, and kind of the rest is history, right? So that led me down this rabbit hole of looking at guitar related content, you know, how they come up on the side of in YouTube where, you know, watch this next. And this particular video came up, and it's a John Mayer signature guitar, I guess, mm-hmm. is what it is. But it's one of these things where they used one of Stevie Ray Vaughan's guitars as the inspiration to make it look like it's all weathered and old and beat up. And it just, I mean, yeah, okay, I appreciate the artistry in making it look that way, but
yeah, the craft in creating this thing is impressive.
Absolutely. Yeah. The guy who made it, Mills Custom Guitars is the company that does it. Absolutely. Craftsmanship is incredible. My question is, this strikes me very much as that sort of Lenny Kravitz pre-weathered Leica.
Sure.
Where you didn't earn those scars.
Yep, agreed.
And I wanted to know what you thought of that. So I guess now we know.
Yep.
Moving on.
Okay, next topic. No, I watched this and I was wondering if you were going to go. I had a hint that you were going to go this direction by the fact that you said shortcuts as the.
Yeah, I mean, as an object, don't get me wrong, it is beautiful.
Yeah.
And it is a wonderful.
But the part of where he's staining the springs that are going in the bridge at the back.
Right.
Right. To make them look weathered. And manually cutting out the weathered look on the paint, right? And this kind of stuff.
Like, yeah, almost like using like Friskit film or something.
Yeah, and then he's going in with an X-Acto and cutting. How do you cut through that stuff without going into the wood? Is that just like excellence in being able to do that?
It's probably just muscle memory. You know how deep to go.
God, that's really nerve-wracking when I was watching him do that. I mean, not that it mattered, but you know, it's just... the thing that is interesting to me is that John Mayer, who I actually like and respect as a musician,
he's a great player.
Would really want something like this, as opposed to, oh, I've had this Strat forever and it's all beat up. Mm-hmm. Last Wednesday, I had dinner with my oldest childhood best friend, who I've known since we were three, and he and I used to ride Big Wheels together. Remember Big Wheels? Big Wheels are
awesome.
I do. We used to ride Big Wheels together, and now we have dinner and talk about music and photography and stuff. He's a bassist, and he uses this 1960s era Fender jazz bass that he bought, I think, when he was in high school at a place called East Coast... Was it East Coast Sound? West? Anyway, this place in Danbury, Connecticut that we all used to go to buy instruments. And he and I kind of fell out in high school era because he went to a private school and we just kind of went our different ways for a little while. Mm-hmm. And during that time, he got into playing bass and he went over to this place and he bought this used Fender jazz bass. Because this was at the time when a used Fender jazz bass was not worth all that much because it wasn't cool anymore and everyone wanted to get whatever Ibanez or, you know, whatever the hell it
would have been
the late 80s, early 90s.
Kind of fallen out of fashion.
Now, this bass now is worth probably 10 times what he paid for it because they've come back into fashion and it's original 60s jazz bass, right? Now, it had a little bit of wear on it at the time, but he's been playing it for 25 years.
Right.
And he's traveled the world playing this bass in Cuba and Brazil and Morocco and, you know, name a place, and he's probably been there playing it. And it's beat up and it's worn down and it looks like it's a piece of him. And I totally understand that part of it. I actually got a little nick on my, I wore a little bit of the paint off of my Z the other day. And I was like, oh, look at that. I'm like wearing it down. Now, that's not ideal for resale value, but like whatever. It's my camera. As long as it keeps working as a camera, you know, I'm fine with that. Because ultimately, this is just an object that I carried around while making hundreds and hundreds of pictures, which is exactly what it's supposed to be, right?
Right,
so
right, right.
I think that it's interesting, you know, the classic Winogrand, right?
His Leica that's just beat to hell.
Exactly, right, right. And we've talked about it before, and I'll put a link in the show notes because it's a good picture here. Mm-hmm. I think that there is room for that, but you're right. That only really makes sense if you've earned it, right? Or if it actually is an old guitar that was Stevie Ray Vaughan's or whatever that he bought from Stevie Ray Vaughan's wife, or, you know, the wife gave it to him because she knew that he'd, you know, whatever the thing is, right?
Yeah.
Like, that makes sense to me. But the idea of pre-weathering something just as a point of aesthetics seems really odd to me. It feels, you know, I'm going to say it feels like a poser move, right? And I don't really understand that from a desire point of view. But at the same time, when I was watching this, I was thinking, wow, this guy's starting from a neck and a body and all this stuff. And he's soldering the stuff and he's sanding and he's cutting out. And this must have been like a week's worth of work for this guy to do this one guitar.
Yeah. No disrespect for the artistry that goes into it.
Amazing.
It just feels like wearing, like, you know, a brand new Metallica and Justice for All shirt from Target and claiming that you've always liked them.
Yeah. Well, or, you know what's new, like, is the big thing now is like all the distressed jeans, right? Jeans with holes in them from Levi's. And it's like,
right.
No. If your jeans do get holes in them, fine. But like the whole idea of buying jeans that are already worn down and have holes in them, that's asinine. Like, I'm sorry, that's stupid. I don't care.
I don't know. I mean, I can get that more as fashion than I can as a like as a tool.
Okay, so how is like, this not like, fashion?
Well, I think because it's a tool. It's I don't know. It just feels different somehow.
Hmm.
I don't know.
I mean, look, the from the point of view of a guitarist, I can understand wanting to play an instrument that looks beat up but actually isn't beat up because it's going to play a lot better than the one that's beat up probably, right? I mean, the action on this guitar, the frets, the pickups, all the electronics in the bridge are all going to be brand new, nice, clean, perfectly in-tuned, you know what I mean? And all the rest of it. Like,
sure.
I understand that from the point of view of I'm a touring musician, my guitar just has to work. Oh, I also want it to look cool. Like, I understand the thing, but you got to think that John Mayer has his guitar from high school, which was a Strat, which is probably kind of beat up anyway.
Yeah.
And he should just play that
one. It's just this weird sort of false sense of street cred.
Yeah. And the fact that I think that I've seen John Mayer playing guitars like this, and I would have thought, oh, that's his guitar that he's had for 30 years, because that's what it looks like. But apparently,
that being said, I think I'm going to take some steel wool to my X-Pro.
You know what's actually really funny? When he's working on the neck, and he puts the label on, and he stains the neck. And then there's a point at which he goes and he grabs an X-Acto knife and scrapes the edges, the corners, to expose bare wood.
Yeah, I mean his detail is brilliant. It really is.
Yeah. But it's just so funny. You're like, all I could think was, oh my god, you did all that work and now you're just scraping it with an X-Acto knife. Like, what are you doing? But that's the way it works.
Yeah. Even to the point of like, you know, cigarette burn on the neck or the one sticker that on the SRV version, there's like the one sticker that isn't quite stuck down. Like the reflective sticker that's coming up on the edge.
Yep. I was over somebody's I was talking to Matt the other day about this because I was asking him about that bass and if he had any, you know, problems with it. And he was telling me that the intonation on the upper register. So when he's playing like up high in the neck, it's flat. No, it's sharp. I think he was saying. Anyway, it's the intonation is not great. And part of that has to do with there's a truss rod that goes through the neck and they can tighten or loosen the truss rod to like sort of, it torques the neck a little bit left or right, you know, and this changes the intonation. Anyway, there's things you can do, but his bass is so old that you can't, the truss rod is already tightened all the way. And there's nothing they could do about it. And so he's going to send it to a guy and the guy's going to like basically take it apart and go and file down parts of the front frets to get them more in tune with the lower frets, you know, this kind of thing.
Right.
And I said, how much does that cost? He's like, it's like $120. I was like, you're taking your multi-$1,000 guitar, giving it to a guy who's going to file down frets, which is as fundamental as things get on a guitar, and all it costs is like $120. I'm like, man, these people should be paid more for their work is all I'm saying.
Yeah. It's just weird. I don't know. I thought it was weird.
If you're into this kind of craft, it's pretty cool.
David Sanborn, who tells this story of, you know, the horn he plays is a horn he got in this pawn shop for $25, you know, 30 years ago.
Yep.
And the guy's got access to, you know, the greatest horns that are made, but this is the one that gives him what he needs.
Yeah. The, years ago, I probably told this story before. I shot some pictures of this guy named Gonzalo Silva. I also, ended up recording one of his records. He was this Berkeley guy who left Berkeley years before I did. And, used to busk up in the subway up by Berkeley. And he used to play this, Horner Steinberger knockoff bass guitar, you know, with like the no headstock kind of thing, right? So he had this Horner knockoff Steinberger and he used to play it and he had this sound and he used to like play and sing to, you know, had like a little head mic and sang while he played his bass almost like a guitar. And he had this great sound and then he moved down to New York and I ended up bumping into him on the subway and was like, you're Gonzalo Silva. And he's like, yeah. And I said, oh, I love you. You know, what's going on? He's like, oh, I recorded this record. I just got a master. I got to find a mastering engineer. I was like, I could do that. And so he came over with the mixes and they were no good. I said, bring me the tracks. I'll remix them. And the tracks were no good. I said, we're just going to re-record this whole thing. And I ended up doing the record. Anyway, long story short, one time years ago, he got some gig and he made $3,000. And he said, you know what? screw it. I'm going to go out and buy the Steinberger bass that is the one that this thing is a crappy knockoff of after all these years. He went out and he bought the bass and he played it for a week and he hated it. And he ended up throwing it in the river in a fit of drug or alcohol-induced rage.
Yikes.
But the point is that he went back to this crappy guitar because that's the one that gave him what he needed, right? That's the one that made it sound like him, because he sounds like he sounds, you know? It's just a reality of I don't know. It's just good.
Yeah.
What else we got?
And do we have that? I mean, to go off on another little tangent, do we have that with digital cameras the way we did with analog cameras? I mean, there were, you know, stories of people using Leicas and this particular Summicron lens or this, you know, Noctilux lens or whatever it is to get their look, to get their feel, to feel their way through making pictures.
You could, you know, we were talking about that yesterday when we were looking at the pen work, where in some ways digital cameras have a larger impact on your look than film cameras, in the sense that, you know, if you had a Nikon and a Canon with a 50 millimeter prime on them, both running the same film through them, you'd be hard pressed to tell the difference because the film is going to give much more character than that lens or body ever are. So in some ways, digital cameras have more of a look built in because they are the whole camera. They're the film and the camera, right? So in that sense, I would say yes. The problem is that most people don't use their cameras for 15 years, right? It's not, and these things, while higher end cameras, which have magnesium cores and all the rest of it, are just as rugged as any camera that's ever been made. You know what I mean? You know, you drop a 5D, you pick it up, it's going to work, you know? For some reason, they don't wear the same because ultimately it's plastic on the outside. It doesn't feel the same. And I don't know if anybody's ever made, I mean, I guess like a 5D, and so I think this camera's, I just happen to have the camera next to me, I guess it's metal on the outside, most of it.
That's one of the things that I keep coming back to about the X Pro. It's one of the reasons I love the X Pro is it's cold when I pick it up.
Yep.
Because it's metal.
Right.
There's a feel to it. And yep. I think that's very important. And if I'm being honest, that's probably what I'm fighting against in terms of buying another camera is I should get this.
The Panasonic is never going to feel like that in your hand.
No.
But at the same time, when we were just talking about the cameras with, I guess it was Tyler's question, you know, you said the D500 is the best feeling camera I've ever picked
ergonomically,
up.
Ergonomically, yes, absolutely.
So for you, that completely fits your hand. So if that camera was more so than a Nikon F2 or whatever, don't you have an F2? You have something, right?
Yeah.
So probably that fits your hand way better than an old Nikon F or an AE-1 or a Pentax K1000.
Yeah, I would say that I'm talking about two different things in terms of ergonomics versus just feel.
Okay. So ergonomically, it's great. Feel, it's not that great,
Different. It's just different.
Okay.
Ergonomically, all the buttons and everything are in the right place, and you know that kind of thing on the 300, 500. But there is something about the X Pro and maybe by extension the X100 STF that if people have used those, they just feel a certain way.
Yep, sure.
And it transcends the actual ergonomics of the camera. It's just the way it feels. I mean, everything is fighting against me with that camera. I shoot left eye. It's not built for shooting left eye. You know, you've got to put a thumb grip. A little thumb rest on it so your thumb doesn't rest in the wrong place. You know, I had a regular grip because my pinky drags otherwise on the bottom plate of the camera.
But do you think that that's going to give you, in the same way that the, who are you saying slept with the, oh, Mark Knopfler slept with his Knopfler. Guitar?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, the idea, and you remember that sensation, right? I mean, it was 150 years ago, but you remember the sensation of being a kid and having the one thing that was really meant so much to you that you wanted to sleep with it, right? You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, sleep next to it.
Yeah, sure. It.
Get your minds out of the gutters, listeners.
Come on, people.
But and does that create better work? Or is that all just some sort of fantasy that we want to have?
That's a bigger discussion. That's a bigger discussion. In the short
you want to hold it, so therefore you're going to use it more. Like beyond like just a really basic superficial level. Does believing your camera or your tool is something more than it is imbue you with some sort of superpower?
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe there's something to that.
Or is it like, you know, the musician who records himself while playing a jazz gig, but he's high on cocaine, and then he listens to the recording later and he goes, wow, I thought that was good and it was a bunch of crap.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's a big topic.
All right, we can talk about it some other time.
Yeah. But if you have feedback on it, podcast it on takingpictures.com. Let us know.
We're all over the place today.
We're all over.
Sleeping with your guitar. I never slept with my camera. And when I played piano, you can't really sleep with a piano.
Yeah, well, that's true. I remember seeing Dire Straits in college and being amazed at the level of technique that Knopfler had, and there, I don't remember what song it was. It might have been, might have been Once Upon a Time in the West. But he was leaning against the corner of the stage, just playing this ripping solo. I mean, just amazing, and having this full-on conversation with John Ilsey, the bass player, and just talking and laughing, not looking at what he's doing, just ripping it up. And he kind of nods to him and walks up to the mic and finishes the song. And I was like, are you kidding me with that?
By the way, it's funny that we were just mentioning cameras that are all beat up. Rolly that Penn has, they have in this case at the Penn show, has a hard viewfinder with an eye cup like stuck onto the top, right? Like the way he has it set up. And it was just gaffer taped on.
Nice.
You know what I mean? Like it wasn't some fancy thing. It was just like, oh shit, gotta have this, put it, hey, Jimmy, give me the gaffer tape. You know what I mean? Like it was.
Yeah.
And that's the one he used for probably years. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's tearing a little bit here. Give me another piece. I'll just close that light hole, light leak or whatever. I like that.
Yeah,
idea.
I think that's a big discussion. I think that's a good discussion of does your tool imbue you with
superpowers?
With superpowers, yeah. With some sort of.
Or space.
Yeah.
I'll put it, imbue you with superpowers.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll put that on for next week.
Okay.
All right, we have some quick things here. Magnum. Is this a big discussion?
No, actually, it's a simple discussion. Magnum released a free ebook. It's called Wear Good Shoes, Advice from Magnum Photographers. And if you go to the link, we'll put a link in the show notes. If you go, you just enter in your email address, click the button, and they'll send you a download link. And you can download this PDF of advice from different Magnum photographers on improving the quality of your photographs or technique.
For the record, I think wearing good shoes is important for everyone.
Absolutely.
I don't understand the idea of not wearing comfortable shoes. It's so fundamental to me. Like, I don't care how they look, whatever. It's just, come on. You know?
Yeah.
I just downloaded it. This is pretty cool.
It's neat, right?
Yep. Let me put this on my desktop so I can read it later. I will put a link in the show notes, and we can do that. We can make that happen for people. They can go wear it. Go read this.
They
can go wear good shoes. Sabine Weiss.
Yeah, you want to tackle that now, or you want to move that?
I guess we can move that to next week. And we don't have enough time for the knowing your thing, so we'll move that too.
Okay.
Hey, knowing your thing. Can we... Can we... So I bought a laptop. Can we redux that?
Yeah, sure. What do you think of it? It's the one with the real short travel keyboard too, right?
Yeah, they're all the short travel keyboard now. And the keyboard... It's actually a pretty loud keyboard.
Wait, hold that up again. Oh yeah, it's louder than the one that you've been using.
It's a pretty loud keyboard. Yeah, so the keyboard is the super short travel, although I'm not a huge typer, right? I'm not like a person who's typing thousands of words a day. So that's not a deal breaker for me. Mm-hmm. The trackpad is enormous and is one of those, is the weird new one, right? Where it like clicks and double, you know, where it doesn't click. Like it, right. it clicks, but haptic, it doesn't move.
Yeah, it's haptic. Yeah.
The weirdest part is when they do the like second click. So you click once and then you push further and it clicks another time. Like you mm-hmm. push through the first click and you feel it actually feel like it's moving down more. It's really kind of disconcerting. But overall, small. So I got the low end 13 inch, 8 gigs of RAM.
No touch bar.
8 gigs of RAM, 256 SSD. Like this is not my main machine. This is a shuttlecraft for me.
What do they want for another 8? Was 16 even an option?
It was $200 for another... $200
for another 8 gig.
Yeah, Jesus. And I think it was $200 to go to 512. So it would have been another $400 to go to 16 wow. and 512, which for me, again, if it was my only computer and I was plugging it into a monitor and external stuff, like, which actually could work, you know, I would probably do that, but I chose not to. I also bought it refurb, so it lists for $14.99. I got mine for $12.69
mm-hmm.
From Apple. I had it actually shipped to one of the Apple stores, and Chris Connors and I went over and picked it up yesterday because he was in town with me. And it's cute. I got the little space gray one, which is like the darker gray one. The right. screen is excellent. I calibrated the screen, and you put a picture up, and you stick it next to my, you know, way more expensive, fancier monitor here at home, and it's mm-hmm. within spitting distance. Like it's good enough to work on that I wouldn't think that I was going to come home and be embarrassed by what I was looking at.
Right. Right.
The resolution is great. So yeah, trackpad and keyboard are okay. The speakers are actually pretty good. My wife was watching a show on Amazon or something last night while she was working out, and the speakers are way better than her little MacBook Air. We were just testing it out. The only downsides that I've found so far are the fact that it has only two of the ports on the side.
Are they both USB-C?
They're both USB-C Thunderbolt 3 ports. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, they are 40 gigabit per second PCI Express connections, essentially, is what they are, right? So they're massively powerful. And there are plenty of little junction box sort of things you can plug into these things and then get three USB connections and Ethernet and an SD card reader and et cetera, et cetera. But I don't have any of those now. The only thing I have currently, I bought one of the little USB-C to A adapters, which they charge $20 for, which is absurd. It's Apple.
Yeah.
It's funny because there was one thing when people were complaining and they actually lowered the price to $9 and then apparently they brought it back up again. It's like, no, just leave it at $9. So overall, it's small, it's light, it's about the same size. It's actually physically smaller than a 13-inch MacBook Air. So it's tiny.
Hmm.
And it is pretty fast. So I haven't put Capture One on it yet. I got to do that today. But I put Lightroom on it, and yesterday's picture, I had somebody over here, and I ended up tethering to it through Lightroom, and it worked. At one point, I didn't turn off the power saving mode thing, so I was chatting for a minute and a half and the screen went kind of halfway, the computer half went to sleep to save battery.
And, oh really?
You know what I mean, just because that's the way the power settings normally are, because they don't
right,
figure
right.
And when I woke it back up, the camera and Lightroom weren't talking correctly, so the tethering kind of stopped working, and I was like, screw this, and I took it off, which is 90% of the reason why I don't tether. It's just, it slows me down more than it would normally. Mm-hmm. But I could tether to it, which is fine. And the internal SSD does like 3 gigs a second. It's one of the fastest storage systems ever made, apparently. So not bad so far. And I'm going to give it a shot. I guess I'll play with it for a week and see how it works.
Before you send it back.
Yeah. Hey, I'm not you. no. But I mean, overall, I mean, for $1,300, it's pretty impressive piece of tech. Right.
Right.
I don't know that I would choose this normally, but I need a computer and this is the one that's closest. It's basically like a MacBook Air with a high res screen, a Retina screen with really fast internal storage. You know what I mean? That's basically what it is. It annoys me the fact that even SD card readers, most of the USB-C SD card readers are like $50 for the SanDisk one. It's insane.
Right, right.
I'm sure it would be really fast. So it's annoying that I have to plug all these stupid things in to get my pictures off. But, you know, what are you going to do? But yeah, pretty cool. If anybody has any other questions, just let me know. But it's working fine so far. The battery life is pretty good. And with only the two of those ports, I mean, if I had it plugged in, then I'm down to one port. And then so I could tether and have it plugged in, but I couldn't then plug in a SD card reader or another drive, like an external drive to back everything up to or whatever.
I did get another external drive, by the way.
You bought a 4 terabyte spinner?
Yeah, little Western Digital 4 terabyte USB.
When you say little, you mean like a 2.5 inch drive, or are you saying just like it's a 3.5 inch drive?
It's just small. No, it's tiny. I mean, it's the size of...
Is it two stacked 2.5 inch drives that are 2 terabytes a piece? You think that's what it is inside?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know. I didn't look that far. It's fast. It was $119 from B&H.
Yeah.
Yeah. For 4 terabytes.
It is crazy. I was going to buy one of the little Samsung T3s, you know, these SSDs?
Yeah.
Just to have that as to back everything, basically back this computer up to that or work off of that. I mean, that's the other nice thing with USB C 3.1. It's like 10 gigabit per second. So I think that these SSDs do 500 megs a second. You know, it's like, that's fine. It's faster than my internal SSDs on my desktop. That's from 27 years ago, you know?
Right.
The fact that this laptop in many ways is faster than my desktop is really upsetting to me, but I guess you got to do what you got to do. Yeah. But anyway, that's the way I decided to go. A couple of people were just like, don't get that computer. And they had reasons, quote unquote, but I haven't seen anything. There's nothing about this computer that makes me think, oh, this can't do the job for me.
Right. You know? Right.
I will say, you know, what's really weird. Have you ever tethered to a computer? You ever play with
that?
Yeah. Okay. What's weird is that at least every Canon I've used and this camera and every Nikon sort of goes into this weird zombie mode when it's tethered. Where, you know what I mean? The camera sort of, the camera isn't just acting like a camera that occasionally sends the stuff over to the computer. It goes into this weird, like, I'm talking to somebody else over here. Hold on a second. Like it's tentative. And if it's not sending, you had unplug, plug, and then you can't hit the shutter button and all kinds of weird things happen. I just don't understand why these cameras can't just work like it's a normal camera. And then, oh, I happen to be tethered. I'll just send those photos when I'm done writing them to the card or whatever, you know.
Is it a software issue or is it a hardware issue with your particular camera?
Well, I mean, this has happened with every sort of regular digital SLR and this camera that I've ever used tethered. It's just sort of, it feels like USB sort of takes over the camera in some way, as opposed to it just being another card for it to send stuff to, you know. And I think it maybe has something to do with the PCP or whatever the USB mode that it goes into, like point to point PTP, PCP, whatever the hell the thing is. I think it has something to do with the way that USB works in this context, that it's sort of, and I think these cameras, it's a little bit of an afterthought. So they just sort of add it on, but they don't have enough horsepower to do it well and do all the normal stuff the camera's doing. It's just something I've noticed.
Interesting.
Yeah. You got anything else before we go to the group and talk about that stuff?
Not really. Still looking at the Backblaze versus Crash plan. I think you're not going to go wrong with either one, but
I used Crash plan. The upload speed is much slower on Crash plan.
Is it?
Dramatically so. Crash plan said it was going to take like 9 months for me to upload my stuff, and it took 2 months on the other one.
Wow. Okay.
And when I say upload myself, I mean like 9 terabytes of stuff, you know, like tons of stuff.
Isn't there I thought Backblaze had a...
You can get the drive and send it to them, that stuff?
No, there was a tester to see what your upload speed would be.
Oh, yeah, it could be. Yeah, the crash plan would not saturate my pipe where Backblaze would. Interestingly enough, my buddy Craig just moved out to Maplewood, New Jersey, and he ended up getting a 1 gigabit Fios connection for $80 a month.
Wow.
Symmetrical.
Wow.
1 gigabit.
That's
that would speedy. Be pretty nice.
You could totally play Quake on that.
Yeah. With the entire world simultaneously.
The group.
Yeah, let's go to the group.
What was the last thing? Last one was
pulling it up. Hold on.
Hands, right. Hands.
Hands across the water.
Water. Yeah. Mario Mirabile, that's a terrific tattooed hands. I dig tattooed hands.
That
I think
would
it
hurt.
Would. Especially across the knuckles there.
Oof. Yeah.
Nice one though. Tim Timoteo, man on the right, fell on an uneven stretch of sidewalk. I was hoping to arrive while his hands were still splayed on the sidewalk. Nice one, Tim. I was hopefully arriving while he was still in pain. When he started to move toward his feet, I hoped the man he was walking with would offer him some help up. Here are their outstretched hands. Humanity is alive and well in Philly.
It's not that bad, people. The world is not the end of, you know.
The world?
Yeah, exactly. Robert Barone, his mother's hands fixing his aunt's hair way back in the day. That's so cute. Beautiful. Barry, look at that.
Hands of a shoe repairer. Andrew Shields, another one with tattoos on the hands, like bones on his hands.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yep.
Michael Atanasio. No, Atanasio. I've been away for a while, but listening to the podcast, always love my wife's hands. Well done. This was a fun one. I mean, it's interesting to see how people look at hands.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we are humans, so hands end up evoking something regardless of what you're doing with them. I like Tyler's picture of the ape with his hands.
Yep.
Hey, that 5200 looks fine to me.
Mike Kukavica, small act of love during chemotherapy. That's
chemo.
That's that's a familiar one. Fernando. Wow, Old Delhi. That's great. Look at that. Look at the henna tattoos.
Yeah. You have henna tattoos?
None that I'll show, but yeah, a couple. Okay,
sure.
Yeah, they're nice. They keep wearing off though.
What do you think we do at night when we get home from work?
Dave Dickey, this is a cool shot looking into an OR. That's kind of neat.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
Like somebody's holding open. Ugh. Oh,
yeah, what are they doing? What are we seeing here?
I don't know.
Oh, mastectomy.
I'm glad we're not any closer.
Great. Yeah. My sister used to, when she worked at the Liberty Science Center, at lunch, they used to transmit operations into the IMAX theater. Like one day a week.
Wow.
And you could go watch. And my sister used to go eat her lunch and watch surgery.
Right. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I just can't. I can't do that. I'd faint.
Yeah. Tim Timoteo, it was like she was standing on empty corners casting spells on traffic with her hands. That's a cool shot.
Yeah.
I love that we don't see her. We just see the hand. That's a nice one, Tim. Really nice.
Did you have something good in mind for next week?
What do you, asymmetry.
I like asymmetry. I both like asymmetry. The idea and I like asymmetry as a concept.
All right. So asymmetry is next week.
Okay.
Have some fun with that.
Have some asymmetry on
us.
I'm sleepy. Me too. I think it's allergies.
I don't know, but I feel like I could just go take a nap.
You know, it's never a good idea, Jeffrey.
Taking a nap?
Taking a nap is fine. As long as, yeah.
I got work to do. I got work to do.
Yeah, me too. Good.
Photographer of the week. You found this one, and this is
Well, I didn't find this one. Somebody sent this in.
Oh, right.
Who did send this in? Suggested Father of the Week, Kenneth Ingham.
Father of the Week? Why is it the Father of the Week?
I'm sorry. Suggested Photographer of the Week. Did I say Father of the Week?
Are we doing a new thing?
Weird. Suggested Father of the Week, Father Joe!
Yay! Paging Dr. Freud. How would you... Chima? Chema?
Chima?
Chima?
Chima Maddox. Wow, this is okay. So we're gonna put a link in the show notes. C H E M A, separate word, M A D O Z. This gentleman, born in 58. So what does that make him? That makes him 60 years old. Something about that. Something about that, 59 years old. That's sure. Right. Right. Makes these pictures, and I'm gonna put a link in the show notes here. Creates some really okay. Did you watch the abstract with what's the Christoph?
Yeah,
you know that illustrator guy, right?
Yeah,
who is taking shadows and then drawing stuff around the shadows, and that mm-hmm, becomes mm-hmm, a work mm-hmm. of art. I feel like in some ways, this guy is sort of a photographic equivalent of that kind of thing, right? He's coming up with like cute ideas that you go, oh my god, how would I not have seen that before?
Yeah, there's a sense of whimsy to his work that we It looks like he simultaneously takes the work very seriously, but doesn't take the work very seriously.
Yes. Yeah. So there is an example here on the homepage, which I really love, which is, it looks like a mousetrap, and in the middle, instead of cheese, is a wedding ring, is an engagement ring, right? You know, yeah. like this kind of silliness, right? He's got, he has one where he takes a brass knuckles and puts a B and an M at the other end, and it just writes out boom, you know, because mm-hmm, the brass mm-hmm. knuckles end up being like a bunch of O's. He's doing things that, you know, you'd look at it and you go, oh man, why didn't I think of that? That's pretty genius. He stuck a mirror ball, like a disco mirror ball in a globe stand. So just, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Just really ingenious stuff that I would really not have thought of.
Yeah, it's really inventive. Yeah, I enjoy this stuff quite a bit. There's a, you know, the metal grates in with the long slats in them in the concrete or in sidewalks. He's put some dishes in there as if it were like a dish drying rack.
Yeah.
And then photographed that.
Did you see the one where it's a perfectly an ice cube with a bow around it and it's melting, so it looks like a present?
The
present's melting. Yeah, this guy is. This is the kind of stuff that I would totally buy one of, and this is the kind of thing I would totally put on my wall if I had money for art, you know.
Right.
Because this stuff is really kind of ingenious. Using a razor blade as a bookmark. Eek, that's tricky. Whoever, this guy's pretty great.
Who sent this in to us? I didn't see this.
Kenneth Ingham.
Oh, thanks, Kenneth.
This guy is, you know, it's, you and I look at a lot of pictures, and it's very rare that you and I look at ones where we go, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, like that's just a totally different way of looking at things that I hadn't really thought of before.
Yeah, it's a very different take on.
Did you see the one with the records in this place on cymbal stands? So it's like a drum set. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of fun.
By the way, last week, I went to a guy named Michael Fremmer's house, who is the analog editor for Stereophile magazine, and got to listen to his like $350,000 stereo at his house out in New Jersey.
Right.
And it was so good. You would have loved it, Jeffrey. He was just like, what do you want to hear? And I was like, I don't know. Steely Dan. And he's like, you want Asia? You want Gaucho? And I was like, say Gaucho. And he goes, all right. I have four or five different pressings of Gaucho. He like pulls them out and puts one on. And it's like, man, there's people who are in love with absolutely everything. Everything you could ever imagine, there's somebody who obsesses about it.
Sure.
It's kind of what's neat about the world, right? That people's interests are so varied, kind of it makes you happy, you know.
I agree.
You got anything else to say about this gentleman? Oh, come on, the one where it's the mirror on the wall and he leans the ladder up against it, so that you see the ladder going down inside the wall. Yeah. Come on. So
Jose
obvious.
Maria Rodriguez Mados, better known as Chema Mados, Spanish photographer.
God, he's so good.
Yeah,
this stuff is so good. Now,
it almost reminds me what's his name with the seven enlargers?
Oh, the guy who's doing the composite stuff.
Yeah. Jerry Olsman.
Yep.
Some of his stuff, but it looks like he's this guy is getting a lot more in camera.
Yeah, I think this guy's doing almost everything in camera, just basically mm-hmm. creating these still lifes that are ingenious. This is the kind of stuff that I wish that I could think of, you know. Oh, come on, a rake standing up on the ground and then he creates a sundial out of it.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
Yeah, this guy
so
sucks.
Whimsical, very inventive. Yes, it's surrealist, but not like Dali surrealism, more like sort of those optical illusion or just clever tricks of composition.
Yep. There's one over here of a butterfly, you know, pinned to the wall, yeah. except yeah. it's using a dart like a
Yeah.
It's so good. I hate people like this. Yeah, this is pretty good. All right, so go check this out, people, if you're bored. This is really definitely worth your time. Wow, okay. Mr. Meadows or Maddows, what do you think?
I think probably Maddows.
Like Rachel?
Chema Maddows.
Yeah. If you want to get a hold of us, 347-687-9411, you can leave us a voicemail. Podcast and I'm Taking Pictures goes to Jeffrey and I. Jeffrey Sidoris, Bill Wadman on Instagram and Twitter, and
yep.
anything else?
Just no.
Okay.
I don't think so.
All right.
Have a good week.
Yeah.
Go make some art.
Excellent.
I'm going to go make more emulsion transfers.
Transfer that emulsion.
I finally got a system that's working for me.
Are you using caustics or?
And caustic is different. That's going to be, yeah. Yeah. Wise ass. No, I'm not using caustics.
Yeah, too bad.
I found a better solution that'll work in printers that aren't able to print very thick material.
I'm sorry. Are you saying that your solution is a solution?
No.
Okay.
No, it's a particular paper. I'm going to do a tutorial on how to do it because I've had a bunch of people. I posted a couple things on Instagram and I've had actually several people email me and go, how are you doing this? What is this? What's going on here?
Yeah.
Very so, cool. It's arguably the same basic principles and techniques that I've used before, but I found a way to get the substrate through a printer that doesn't allow you to print on, because I was printing on like 1.5 millimeter polypropylene sheeting, actually 1.3 millimeter. But the Canon printer that I currently have does not print on material that thick. So I needed to find something that would release the acrylic.
And the Kraken.
That's right. Without having it stick. Release the Kraken. On that note, have a good week, everyone.
See you. We are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. As this way, say what you wanna say.
how many people just burst blood vessels rolling their eyes?
Release the Kraken. What is that from originally?
I think maybe Clash of the Titans.
Yeah. Let's see.
Harry Hamlin.
Release the Kraken meme is a catchphrase. You are correct. Image and macro series based on a memorable quote uttered by Zeus in the 1981 fantasy adventure film
there
Clash
you go.
Of the Titans, as well as the 2010 3D remake.
Put despite that the, at the end of the show, mister.
Despite the dramatic delivery of the line in the reboot, the quote was perceived as unintentionally funny, quickly became the target of Image macro jokes on the internet.
Release the Kraken! Yeah.
I'm going to put a link to this link in the show notes to that one. Yeah, you got anything else? I think we're good.
I think we're good.
All right, I'm going to hit stop now.